Here we go. Hey there, folks. This is your host, Cameron Ivey of Privacy Please, and thank you so much for tuning in each and every week. If this is your first time, welcome to the show. Tell your friends about it if you like it. If you don't, let's just pretend you didn't listen to it. Thanks again for coming in, and we hope you enjoy the show. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Privacy Please. I'm your host, Cameron Ivey, and with me, as always, Gabe Gums. Gabe, how you doing today?
Good. It's Friday Eve.
Friday Eve.
Although we don't release this on Friday Eve, but it's Friday Eve, so that's how I'm doing.
So in other terms, it's Thursday. Sure. You didn't get that. we have an awesome guest today. His name is Chris Grunderman. He's the VP at Myrid 360. He's referring to himself as the COO. Chris, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me on as the secret COO. That's great.
Just got an upgrade, more work, same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's me that said it, not Chris. So, Chris, tell us about yourself. We'd love to learn a little bit more about your background.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, my background is mostly in networking, which has had a piece of security for a long time. I cut my teeth pretty early on helping to build some internet service providers, specifically a wireless internet service provider doing basically wireless home broadband in Colorado in underserved areas. This was back at the turn of the century, I guess. It's a funny term to always say, but at the turn of the century, in the areas outside of the city, there wasn't DSL access, there wasn't cable access. And so a lot of folks had dial-up internet, or maybe they had a satellite dish strapped to their roof. And this company, originally called Hometown Access, went out and basically put towers on people's homes out in the woods around the surrounding areas of around Denver there, and provided internet access to these folks. And so I kind of jumped in there and helped. And one of the things that was interesting as a place to cut your teeth in networking was we basically built all of our routers ourselves. So they were essentially Linux servers that we were turning into bridging routers. So they just had a bunch of scripts that ran to get them set up and install static routes through kind of Perl scripts and things like that. So kind of a wild way to get into networking, but also definitely gave me an early dose of Linux, which has helped me throughout my whole career, and also security, because these were all bastion hosts that had to be secured from the ground up. And so that's definitely always been in my DNA since then. Went on from there and ended up working at some bigger networks, helped build out the network at TW Telecom, including rolling out IPv6 across their entire network one night. That they've been bought by Level 3 and then CenturyLink. I also worked at the Internet Society for a while, which was basically a job of traveling around the world, speaking at conferences about technology issues. And so got a good dosing of kind of looking at the policy and politics around the world of how the internet works and how companies work in different countries and things like that, which is really interesting. Along the way, I worked at Cable Labs doing some R&D for the cable industry, which ended up, I won the 2012 Inventor of the Year Award at Cable Labs, which was pretty cool. Especially, being somebody who came from pretty humble background and working alongside people who had PhDs or multiple PhDs and coming out of there with 8 patents with my name on them was pretty fun. I wrote a couple books on IPv6 along the way. And then the last 5 years or so, I've actually kind of turned all of that and really focused it into the company I work for now, which is Myriad 360. We're a consultancy and integrator out of New York City. We focus on cybersecurity solutions and data center infrastructure. And so I've done a lot of things for them in the last 5 years. And a big part of that was really laying out our cybersecurity strategy. So me and another gentleman by the name of Leo Cruz were really kind of the first ones there to kind of build up the cybersecurity practice for Myriad. Now we've got a ton of great engineers involved. But in building that up, we did some cool things, I think. And one of them was actually looking at trying to help educate our salespeople on security and how to talk about it with customers. So we created essentially a reference model for cybersecurity that breaks it out into 4 domains. And then each domain has 6 different areas within it to kind of really differentiate where the different pieces of infrastructure go in a comprehensive enterprise security solution. So I think that fits neatly into some of the other areas of reference models that are out there. And then we also really started, in conversations with customers, really tried to understand, how does cybersecurity apply in that in the real world, and came up with this idea of a secure and mobile workforce, which now I think is a lot of people kind of talk about that in different languages or different words, which is really looking at, you know, how do you, you know, allow people to connect anywhere they want, which obviously this year has become even more important. You know, accelerated some trends this year, but you know, how do you allow everyone to work anywhere they want, anytime they want, and do it securely, right? So really looking at the mobility side of security and how that plays into enterprise security. So those are some of the big pieces as far as recently. Yeah, I think that's kind of my background.
That is a fascinating background. As someone who also got their start in networking, although to date myself, I was converting Token Ring to Ethernet, so we're not going to go there. You're right, though. Like, security has always been a part of that. I mean, it originally started as just, you know, basic port security. Open a port, close a port. Open a port, close a port. Back when security was easy. But my question for you isn't related to that at all. You've said a number of interesting things in your background that I do want to double click into a little bit. This is a show where we talk about security and privacy. And you mentioned some of your work in looking at policy around the world. So policy around the world. In the U.S., we have yet to declare certainly digital privacy as a fundamental right. There's some allusions to it in the Constitution, but I think like case law isn't settled on that. Versus like in India 3 years ago, their Supreme Court mandated and stated explicitly that there's a right to privacy. It's a fundamental right that's built into their Constitution. Granted, their Constitution's a bit younger than ours. Internet is a fundamental human right, though. Where do you land on that one?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, that's definitely something. I'll take the second part of that first, right? And it's definitely something that I've seen as a trend throughout, you know, the you know, almost 20 years working in this field that I have, is, you know, the internet moving more and more towards being a utility and a basic human right. And especially now, I mean, again, another thing that, you know, in these strange times with, you know, lockdowns and everything else that's going on around the pandemic, is we've really, again, accelerated that trend as well, which is looking at areas in the world and in this country, which I think is surprising to some people, but, you know, within the United States, there's huge areas that have very limited internet access. There is, and I forget the exact number, so I'm not going to try to make it up on the spot, but there's a very large, alarmingly large number of people in New York City who don't have access to broadband internet, which is just, you know, it kind of mind blowing at some level. And so thinking about, you know, what we take for granted with internet access, and especially now with, you know, if you're not able to leave your home and everything's online, you've got to go to school online, you've got to work online, you know, not having a reliable internet connection can actually be really devastating at this point. I've talked to some folks, and this is what goes into, kind of bleeds into the privacy side of that, right? Which is, you know, a lot of people get alarmed about certain big technology companies collecting so much data on them. And, you know, the idea of opting out of that becomes, again, almost impossible, right? You essentially can't do a lot of things if you decide that you really want to keep all of your data private. And that was definitely a big topic of the Internet Society, was this idea of your digital footprint and what kind of breadcrumbs, what kind of trail are you leaving behind just by visiting regular websites, doing searches, you know, all that stuff. There's so much data you leave out there. And so even once you have that internet access, you know, then keeping yourself secure and private, especially private in doing so, is really, really tough, because there is this digital trail of kind of everything you do and everything you look at and everything you buy and you know, companies and governments collecting all that information. So it is alarming. And there's definitely some area to say that the United States is behind the curve on many of those things, right? So if you look at, even in particular, at GDPR in the European Union is pretty big on personally identifiable information. That's something that's been taken seriously by a lot of European countries for a long time, as far as data collection and individual rights, as far as who owns their data and those kind of things. So there's definitely some play there. And it, like I said, if you zoom out and look at the globe, becomes alarming at the differences in both internet connectivity, but also the protections of privacy of individuals, for sure.
The number, by the way, is 917,000 households in New York lack broadband. 917,000. It is a shame, right? Because I remember the first time I got access to broadband in New York City, and I remember being just like chomping at the bit, waiting for it to get closer to me, and it was an ADSL line, you know, brought to you courtesy of what is Verizon. And your work on rural internet access also strikes home for me too, because I remember having some heated conversations years ago at this point with some folks that were trying to sell some products that really relied on it. And I was like, I don't know how you plan on making money on this business model, considering the number of American homes that don't have it. And having that conversation, they just kind of looked at me like, what are you talking about? Everyone has access. I'm like, no, they don't. You also mentioned kind of looking at this around the globe. There's some interesting things here that stand out to me as well. Because we have been a quote unquote first world country for so long, it means we have a lot of legacy infrastructure, right? Landlines and things of that nature that brought internet to people. A lot of countries that were not able to get themselves infrastructure ready throughout the 19th, 20th century kind of leapfrogged us, right? So because they never had to lay landlines and they decided to just skip over it, they just roll in 5G out. So now they actually have more internet access than we do in the US. Do you see kind of, the old 5G internet access coming to the US and solving some of those problems you were solving for in the rural parts of this country?
Maybe yes and no, right? I mean, and one thing, obviously, there's a lot of places, especially in Africa, which is a gigantic continent, right? And I think that that's one place where you've definitely already seen that leapfrogging, where they, like you said, they went straight to mobile internet, right? There was no desktops, there was no PCs, there was no laptops. It just went straight to, and a lot of times that mobile internet is actually still working on feature phones. It's not even what we would call smartphones, but they're able to use that for payment systems and all kinds of things. So they're, people are able to go from the rural areas into the cities, work, make more money than they could at home, but send that money home, in real time. Different vendors are able to, sell wares and sell goods and services, just by using payment over a cell phone, which is a lot easier than carrying cash around in some, areas that maybe you wouldn't want to carry cash around, right? So that is super interesting. As far as applying to the United States, though, there still is difficulties in the rural areas, right? Because the density is what matters. And if you're just looking at this from an ROI, right? If you're, and you don't want to single anybody out, but if you're Sprint or Verizon or AT&T or whoever else, going in and building a $100,000 tower to cover an area, you have to see the return on that. And so there's still, even with, currently LTE, but future 5G, there's still definitely some potential big gaps as far as, remotely rural areas. Especially if you think about like up in Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, in the Midwest, there's big areas where there's just not the population density to really support a number of subscribers that would that would actually pay for that service to make it worthwhile from a financial perspective. And so that's still kind of alarming. One area though that is interesting in that space is these low Earth orbit constellations of satellites that a lot of folks are working on, right? I think the SpaceX is working on one. There's a few different companies. OneWeb was a big company that was doing it that just went bankrupt. So I don't know if they're going to make a recovery or not. But the problem is it costs billions of dollars to put these satellites up. The cool thing though is that they can provide access literally anywhere. So when you do these low Earth orbit constellations, they are moving so fast and moving around, they can actually provide internet to the entire surface of the Earth potentially. And it's the same cost of building the system because the system just by nature is global. And so that potentially becomes really interesting for not just rural America, but rural Earth, right?
Right. Brings with it yet some other challenges with regards to, so I've got some folks also, some friends that are into just kind of amateur astronomers and they're not terribly pleased about some of those plans. Although the juxtaposition of that is most of them live in rural parts of the country. Like I've got a buddy who lives like way out in Montana. And so he struggles with internet access, but that type of solution would actually collide head on with some of his other, hobbies, that is. So interesting.
Yeah, that's super interesting. There's definitely a lot of junk already in space, and we're just launching more and more every day, it seems like.
There is a lot of junk in space.
Can we go back to internet society?
Yeah.
I'm curious, what you might have mentioned it already when you brought it back up, but I'm curious if that this kind of equals that, but what was the biggest thing that you took out of that experience? What was the most positive thing that you experienced from that?
That's an interesting question. There's a lot of things, right? So one of the things, just kind of backing up even further a little bit, one of the things that got me into that job eventually was really early on in my career, starting to work in building ISPs and becoming aware of the internet and its capabilities, it really just kind of blew me away, right? The idea that we had this, this global network that can, once everyone's connected, you almost have telepathy, right? I mean, obviously not in the, totally sci-fi sense of like beaming thoughts into each other's heads, but almost, right? Yeah. I mean, at the point where you can talk to anyone in the world and read the views and opinions and knowledge of anyone in the world kind of in real time, and not only read that, right, like having a library card, but contribute to that. It's to me, it's this immense leap forward in human civilization, potentially. And we could get into a conversation about advertising taking over the internet and the web kind of smashing that vision a little bit. But at the same time, that vision is what caused me to really get interested in the internet. And so because of that, I started looking into kind of the policy and politics around it. And I discovered the Internet Society pretty early in my career. And actually, this time I was living in Denver and realized that there wasn't a local chapter of the Internet Society. So I founded the local Internet Society chapter in Colorado and gotten introduced to just kind of a whole world of organizations that are out there to support the internet. The Internet Society being kind of the main one. They're the home to the IETF, which obviously is where all the protocols and standards are created to make the internet work. But also got introduced to the North American Network Operators Group and the American Regional Internet Registry. And just kind of really opened my eyes to all of that. And that was what set me on the path, which ended up with me actually taking a full-time role at the Internet Society. Now, you know, the biggest thing I think I learned actually being at the Internet Society was how hard it is to convince people, not people, but maybe organizations, how hard it is to convince organizations to do something when there's not an ROI attached to it, right? And it's just, I mean, not bashing on capitalism. It's just kind of a fact of the way things work that it's really hard to get an organization to spend money on something that's good for everyone else, but not necessarily for themselves. And we see this in a lot of other areas, but new technologies on the internet, and especially security and privacy technologies on the internet, are one area where this gets really affected, right? So deploying TLS, deploying RPKI, which is a route validation to make sure that nobody can hijack your IP addresses, deploying DNSSEC. There's a number of things that, and IPv6 was another one of them that's not necessarily security or privacy related, but another big technology that is this, I don't know if it's truly a tragedy of the commons, but it is this externalities issue where you've got to spend the money to deploy this new technology, but you don't get to reap the rewards of that until everyone else deploys it. And so, you know, that was a big part of my job at the Internet Society was, you know, the reason I was traveling around the world speaking was I was talking about these new technologies and the benefits to, you know, the internet and mankind, right? That would come from the internet. And there's obviously, you know, a bunch of, you know, really geeky technologists who want to deploy it because it's the new cool thing. And there are some companies out there and organizations who want to deploy it because it's the right thing to do. But then you know, get to a point in that curve where you hit a wall and there's enterprises that say, yeah, we want to do that. But like, we've got to make our numbers. We've got to pay our people, right? We can't make this thing go bankrupt just to deploy a new technology that's going to help people, you know, in 5 or 10 years. And so just that revelation, which was actually a big part of why I ended up at Myriad, where, you know, we can sell technology. And so all the technology we work with is technology that's actually moving the company forward and hopefully as well, moving the internet and privacy and security forward as well.
Yeah, that's so relatable, especially around the security and privacy, obviously, just because, you know, I think that's what all those type of companies that are in the cybersecurity space, that's what they deal with. You know, how can you convince me, you know, ROI on this unless it's a breach that's happened or something that's like physically happened, how can you, you know, help me understand why this is going to be worth thousands and thousands of dollars? But anyways, let's talk a little bit about Myriad 360. Let's go into that and what you guys, you touched on. I don't know if you deem the term, but we talked offline about your go-to-market strategy on privacy and security. Why don't you go a little bit further into that?
Yeah, for sure. So kind of the basis of that was, like I said, really the impetus was trying to educate the salespeople on being able to talk about security for the first time with their clients. And so we created a reference model for cybersecurity that kind of breaks down, and obviously, you know, we're mostly a hardware vendor as well as the consultancy of kind of, you know, designing and installing that hardware. And so it's really kind of hardware infrastructure centric, but a model that hadn't existed before, I believe. And so we broke security into four domains, being perimeter, endpoint and application, identity and access, and then visibility and control. And then with each of those domains, there's six categories, right? And so if you look at perimeter, we're looking at things like network security, email security, web security, the DDoS protections, DLP, and then ecosystem risk management, right? Which I think of like the perimeter of your business more than the perimeter of your network.
Yeah.
And of course, like I said, there's kind of six categories for all those domains. But being able to break it down that way, what ended up happening is, you know, in a way, the reference model escaped the lab, I guess I would say. And this thing that was supposed to be an internal tool, we ended up showing it to the clients and it became a really great selling tool where people could look at, you know, a CIO, a CISO can look at this and be like, yep, we're covered there. We're using this technology here. That's a gap. We didn't even know that was a thing. And you run through it and really end up finding the where there's value to add you know, to this enterprise really quickly. And so, you know, obviously it's no replacement for any of the other models of like, you know, COBIT or ISO or NIST. They're doing really different things, right? From the strategic to the operational to the tactical. This is more focused on specifically on the infrastructure itself and what kind of tools and techniques you're using. But it does kind of couple in with, there's a model that I really like called the Reference Model for Information Assurance and Security, RMIAS, which is a little bit less known, but it's really comprehensive. And one of the things it talks about is, you know, this idea that security countermeasures can be technical, they can be legal, they can be human-oriented, or they can be organizational. And so, you know, remembering that there's not always a technical solution for every problem, it is, I think, super important. And that's, and that follows on our reference model as well, right? There may be an area where you're going to just buy insurance instead of putting technology in place, right? I don't necessarily recommend that in most cases, but it's a possibility. Or maybe you're going to do something more human-oriented, right? Maybe there's training or different, you know, policies you can put in place instead of having to go buy the latest, greatest box or software or whatever. So I think, you know, remembering that you can fill those boxes with multiple different ways of solving the problem is super important. But also, like I said, I think just giving that landscape of, here is kind of the security infrastructure landscape. Here's how you could secure your enterprise, and having a kind of holistic conversation about that really seems to help quite a bit.
Yeah. Sounds like you gave the sales team a really, really awesome resource there for for using that. So let's talk about the challenges around encrypted traffic.
Yeah.
You've touched on that. I'd love to learn more about that myself.
Sure. Well, you know, I definitely wouldn't call myself an expert on encryption at all, but the one thing that I think is fairly clear when you start to, you know, peel back the onion a little bit is the counterplay of privacy and security. And I think one thing that, you know, definitely I learned late in my career, as far as I would consider it, is, you know, the fact that, you know, privacy and security aren't the same thing and at times are at odds with each other. And what I mean is, you know, as more and more applications go to end-to-end encryption, which I think is a great thing. I think that individual privacy is something that, you know, was lacking on the internet for a long time. Mm-hmm. And is something that, you know, it, by some people's definition, like is one of the definitions of civilization, is being able to have privacy and being able to have, you know, private communication. And that's part of free speech, is being able to talk to each other privately and not have someone watching all the time. So I really do believe that the end-to-end encryption is a great thing. But then you have to counterbalance that with, you know, enterprise security and then even potentially national security and global security, which is, if the traffic's encrypted and you can't see it and you can't read it, you can't classify it, you don't know what's in there, it could be totally malicious, it could not be, you don't know. And so there's definitely this push and pull between encryption, I think, and the privacy that it brings, and then, you know, the ability to dig into those packets and understand what's actually going on there and provide security to your organization.
Gabe, you got anything on that?
I mean, encryption in general, in that context, continues to add a lot of new challenges in a privacy first world, right? I still don't know where the balance will lie in being able to share information securely while also preserving privacy in transit. I've seen some things kind of come up in the markets that really kind of rely on abstraction of that information. You've got some differential privacy things, but all of these things happen with the data in use and at rest. I don't see any of those things kind of happening in motion. I feel like that's a problem that if we could solve for, probably would, well, hell, if I could solve for it, I'd be having this conversation from my mega yacht, quite frankly. It's not an easy one, right? Like, and there's so many trade-offs between those two needs that would have to happen, both in terms of the technology as well as the privacy and security. I feel like we may be stuck in this model of encrypt all the things on the wire for some time.
Yeah, definitely. And like I said, I think in a lot of cases, end-to-end encryption really does make a ton of sense for a lot of reasons. It does create some problems if you're trying to, you know, understand the content inside those, but that, I mean, which again is a double-edged sword, right? That's on purpose, but also it can cause some challenges. I think, you know, I have seen some pretty interesting advances in kind of using metadata around encrypted traffic to understand mm-hmm. what's malicious and what's not, right? There's some patterns with packet size and the frequency of packets and how close together they are and how far apart they are. And there's some ways to scope that out. I mean, obviously, you know, security in general is always a cat and mouse game to some degree. It's kind of, seeing somebody do an exploit, figuring out how to stop it, and then, you know, seeing the next exploit and figuring out how to stop it. So obviously I think that'll be a moving target as well. But I have seen some promising work where, you know, even though you don't know what's in the traffic, you can kind of tell, hey, this is expected and this is not expected. and at least have some insight and some abilities there.
So let's go into, you know, finding a balance between enterprise security and individual privacy. By the way, I love that. Just in general, just the enterprise security and individual privacy. What do you really mean by that?
Well, there's a couple of things, I think. And, you know, one of the areas where this really kind of pops out, I guess, is in like user behavior analytics, right? Where, you know, which is a kind of the epitome of, I don't know if that's the right word, but it's kind of really the, you know, the model of Big Brother, where, you know, you're being watched. And if you do something wrong, like steal information or something, or siphon information off to a place it shouldn't be, or steal information, right? That'll be caught. And I think the trade-off there is that if you are using, you know, company-owned equipment, a company-owned software, company-owned connections, that you should expect to be monitored. And I think that's actually okay. I don't think there's actually a problem there. You know, I can see where some people would draw the line in a different place. But I think, you know, if you're using a personal device, doing personal things, then that's a totally different issue. And that's where maybe where, you know, bringing your own device starts to blur that line a little bit, right? So many people are using, maybe they bought their own laptop because, you know, the newest Apple or whatever isn't available from their company, or, you know, they're definitely bringing their smartphone into work, or they're working, you know, from somewhere that isn't work. And so that's where the line starts to get blurred, right? And right. I think, you know, there's some interesting technologies there around, you know, is virtual desktop infrastructure or virtual applications, is that going to make, you know, more of a resurgence than it has in the past, because I want to be able to wall off the stuff that's work and the stuff that's not, and be able to have those connections be separate, right? Some of the SD-WAN technologies also kind of do the same thing, where you can prioritize different applications. You know what's a work application and what's not, and you can kind of, you know, no one wants to decrypt anyone's bank information, whether they're going to the, you know, visiting their mobile bank from work or not. But you definitely do want to look at, you know, when they're pulling data out of the S3 bucket that belongs to the company. So, you know, I think, you know, that it's really hard to draw one big bright line between the two things. And so navigating that becomes an interesting job for sure, of understanding, you know, what is personal and protected use, what is company use that needs to be monitored and watched. I don't think there's any real easy answers there, but I do think it's an evolving realm of discussion and policy and technology that's going to continue for a long time.
Yeah, certainly. I'd like to ask this question, and it's okay if you don't really know, but what is data privacy? When you hear the term data privacy, what does that mean to you personally? And what does that mean to your company? How does your company go about that?
Yeah. A number of things, right? And I don't know that I have the best answer. You're right. But, you know, in general, right, I think the main way I would look at that particular term of data privacy is confidentiality, right? And kind of the CIA, you know, the old CIA triad, pretty simple. Mm-hmm. And so it's really about, you know, if you want that data to be private, it's a matter of who has access to see it, right? And so I think, you know, when I think of data privacy, I first start thinking about some of the challenges involved in classification of data, to understand which data belongs to what group and who should have access and who shouldn't, right? So classifying the data becomes the first problem, and then, or the first challenge, and then providing the right access based on the classification becomes kind of the second piece of that. So that's definitely kind of the two-step process, as far as making it really simple. A very complex subject, really simple, is all about classification and then ensuring the right access. Of course, integrity plays into that as well, but that can be monitored kind of separately than privacy, I think.
That's a good point. It's just interesting how some companies approach data security and data privacy. I feel like some organizations are very behind in the way that they kind of approach it. But luckily, privacy is kind of hitting us in the face, especially nowadays. I mean, we're having commercials with iPhones where it's literally a commercial about privacy.
Yeah,
I don't know if you've seen them, but it's fascinating because Apple is always at the top of their game. And it's just impressive because, I don't know, I think it sends a message when something that big kind of puts that at the forefront with the little lock that attaches to the Apple like logo. It's pretty cool. But glad to see that it's kind of moving forward. And that's why we do this podcast. And that's why we have this community, because it should be more and more important. So before I get onto some of the last segments, is there anything that you want to bring up that we didn't get a chance to bring up, or anything that you want to kind of say to our listeners, maybe that might have been in your position or in your position that that it might be helpful for them moving forward?
I don't know. I mean, definitely a little bit of the former. I think you're right that when a major company, somebody as big as Apple, makes privacy, you know, a differentiator. I mean, I think that's definitely a good sign. Right. It's a good sign in one way. It's a bad sign in another, because the bad sign is that they're showcasing the fact that other companies are not doing that. The fact that that's a differentiator is can be a little bit alarming. But I do think overall that that it does point to a really good trend, which is that security is becoming something that people actually pay attention to. For a long time, a lot of enterprises just, it was really a second thought, if at best, you know, if at all. And, you know, the downside is, I think it was probably a lot of big, you know, headline breaches that caused the awareness. But now that we have that awareness, folks are actually paying attention to it and really digging in, both on a personal level, but also at an organizational level. So I do think we're in a much better place than we were 10 years ago, definitely 5 years ago, even. With just the general awareness, right? Which, as people talk about kind of shifting security left, I think that's actually happening in a lot of people's minds. Organizations are thinking about security, and individuals are thinking about privacy, and they're actually selecting which applications they use based on how much information is taken and not, and looking at looking at the different permissions that are allowed on each application and things like that. So I think at both levels, it's happening, and that's a really good thing.
Agreed. Let's just hope it's not too late.
Yeah.
Let's hope the technology isn't too far ahead of us. One last question for me. I don't know if Gabe, if you have anything, but before we move on to our fun segment where we get even more private.
I have one more, but it straddles the line between serious and fun. So maybe that'll be a good transition in.
Okay.
Building your own routers. They were all Linux based. So two questions. First question is, what's your favorite Linux OS, A, and B, why is 2021 the year of the Linux desktop?
So number one, I mean, you're definitely going to get me shot full of arrows here for picking out anybody. For a long time, because all of the stuff I was working on with CentOS, I actually used that for my desktop for a long time. These days, I've actually transitioned over to an Ubuntu desktop. And so I'm into the Debian family now. Which plays into the 2021 being the year of the Linux desktop. At least for me, it is. So I actually... Recently, I moved down to Texas from New York back in March. And when I was sitting here, the original plan was to use this as a home base and travel a lot, because I used to travel quite a bit for work. Obviously, this year it came to a screeching halt. So I was like, okay, since I go to so many conferences and things, what I really need is like a super amazing tablet that'll be like a laptop replacement. And I was looking at them, and the price is pretty high, right? If you really want to go full bore for a laptop replacement, you're talking about thousands of dollars. And so then I was like, well, if I'm going to pay $1,000 for a tablet, I might as well get, you know, full, like, big laptop. And then we got locked down, and I said, well, if I'm going to pay $1,000 for a laptop, I might as well buy, you know, a big desktop. So I actually built, for the first time in a long time since I was a kid, built my own PC and built it up to be a virtual reality gaming rig. And I decided to go all in with Linux. And I actually set it up to dual boot between Linux and Windows. And I'll be honest, it's been quite a few months now. I have not installed Windows on it. I'm using it just as a Linux desktop. I got Ubuntu running. I got my 48-inch ultra wide screen here with two other monitors in front of me. And, I run labs on the thing. I do, you know, obviously podcasts from the thing. Do my work all day to day. I'm using OpenOffice. And so for me anyway, 2021 is the year of the Linux desktop. So I invite everyone else to join me.
Well, the second question was a trick question. Every year is the year of the Linux. They've been telling me that literally since 2004. Nice. Welcome to the Debian side of the family.
Sorry to disappoint you, Gabe. It wasn't me, though.
The bar is not really set.
I know. Well, let's go ahead and move on to our fun segment. Where I ask you odd questions and we get to learn more about you and how you think.
Okay. Interesting.
So let's just start it off with easy. I'll throw some at you. What is your biggest pet peeve?
My biggest pet peeve. I have so many, I think.
I'll hear them all. I love it.
I've actually like started numbering them out on Twitter. I'm trying to think of one good one. But right now, one of the things is, folks who are presenting over Zoom and they don't mute or close the other applications on their computer. So like they're presenting some slides and there's like just weird like dings and woots and woo-haws going off. I understand if your dog barks or your kid cries, right? I mean, that's going to happen. But sure. You have the control over the noise on your laptop. You can shut that down. I don't have to hear all that. That's probably the biggest one right now, anyway, today.
I would have to agree, especially if you're having like a giant meeting with like 10 plus people or whatever, and you're not even someone that's talking, but you forget to put yourself on mute immediately. Yeah. And then you just hear someone yell at somebody. It's just, I don't understand it at all. It makes me want to.
Zoom etiquette definitely jumped to the top of the pet peeves. Yeah.
Yeah. What is your guilty pleasure?
Guilty pleasure. That is another good question. Most of my pleasures are pretty public. I don't know. I'm trying to think of like, what's a guilty one. I think that, maybe listening to like techno versions of cumbia. I like to just rock out to some cumbia from time to time, which isn't normal for a person of my background.
Now I'm interested in hearing a sample of that.
I'm interested in hearing that come on in the middle of a Zoom meeting when somebody
There you go. That might be the time.
Yes.
What's the best Wi-Fi name you've ever seen?
Ooh, I mean, you definitely see like the FBI truck number two ones out there. I think most of the best ones I've seen, I probably wouldn't want to repeat on this podcast, but
there's the answer I was looking for. Yeah. I can't repeat what I've seen.
Yeah.
What do you think the funniest for a sport, what would be the funniest to add mandatory amount of alcohol to?
That mandatory for the players?
Yeah.
I mean, I was going to say lacrosse, but that could get ugly pretty quickly.
Good. Yeah.
It might not be funny. It might just be terrible at some point.
Maybe hockey, because it's similar, but they're on skates.
I'm pretty sure they're all already drunk. So
maybe so. Maybe
that's rugby.
Figure skating would be the funniest, I think. I'd like to see some like triple lutzes on vodka.
Yeah.
It'd have to be hard liquor only. Can't be any wine or beer.
Slide with the wine.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. This is a serious question on Privacy Please. Toilet paper situation for you, is it over or under when you put it on the roll?
Under.
Whoa, okay. Maybe we should dive into that.
Live in a society, Chris.
So here's the thing, what? I've got kids. I don't currently have a cat, but I've had cats in the past. And in both of those situations, stray hands batting a roll of toilet paper, if it's under, nothing happens.
Judges will allow it. That is the first and only time I have heard a decent explanation for why under is a reason to create additional chaos. Yes, yes. I clearly see that you are chaotic good. And the judge will allow it.
There we go. All right.
Yep. You passed on that one. That's good. let's see here. What's the weirdest thing a guest has done at your house?
Turned his toilet paper over.
Installed toilet paper on, obviously.
Who did this?
Weirdest thing a guest at my house. You know what? I mean, it's been a long time. It was back in my early 20s. I must have been out of toilet paper because someone actually pulled some wallpaper loose from the wall and used that as a replacement for the toilet paper that was apparently missing.
I've done worse. And that's all I'm going to say. Edit. That's all I'm going to say. So that's not bad. do you have a go-to joke? That's just you. It's one of those jokes you tell to everybody. You can't help it.
I'm not good on jokes. You know, I'm bad at memorization. So I always forget the right words. I'm more of a story guy. And
okay. Do you have any good stories for us? Short stories?
I can't think of a short one. No, sorry.
Okay.
I talk too much.
What would you say is the worst song you've ever heard?
The worst song I've ever heard, man.
You just can't stand it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you go back to the classics, right? Like the ones that just were on repeat and you couldn't get them out of your head, but they're kind of terrible. Like Who Let the Dogs Out? I mean, I know I'm going way back. I'm dating myself here. the Mac Arena, right? I mean, just stuff in that category where you end up singing along with it and hating yourself for it. Those are the ones.
May I add one to the list?
Yeah.
Baby shark, baby shark,
baby shark, baby shark. All right. That definitely goes on the list. Yeah, that's
I have not. I didn't hear that. I've never heard that version, and I've played many versions for my son. So I didn't know where that was going until I heard the water bubbles. But that's definitely one of them. Yep. Chris, if you had a superpower, what would it be?
Teleportation. Love travel, but I can do without the airports and the planes. Just go where I'm going, pop up, have dinner, pop home, be great.
So does teleportation lie within being able to jump back in time and go into the future?
Ooh, I mean, I don't even know if I want that, but it could. I mean, they're definitely related powers.
Okay.
Right? I mean, because if you're traveling through space, you might as well be traveling through time because they're the same thing.
You are, yeah.
That's a good point, and that would be a great superpower. We usually get flying or invisibility or something. So that's a great answer because that would be pretty awesome. Mostly any time that I have to do anything where I have to like travel somewhere, I really wish that I could just and you would be where I am.
Pop home, grab clothes out of your closet the next day, take a shower in your bathroom, pop back. You're still there and believe.
What was that movie that was like that? It was the gosh, that's going to kill me. It was the kid that got that superpower. He could basically like teleport anywhere. And he like, there was a girl with him. He was, you know, it was a, whatever. Oh my God. That's going to kill me. I know someone out there listening will know exactly what I'm talking about.
No one will know what you're talking about.
classic Boy Meets Girl story with teleportation.
Yeah, real tearjerker.
No, there was I think what's his name from Matrix was in it.
Right, the guy from the show with
that guy that wore the glasses.
Yeah.
I'm gonna think about it. I'm gonna let you guys know what it is and I'll put it in the notes.
You're gonna put it in the show notes, man. Everybody's gonna want to know now.
Yeah, I got it. It's like a movie from the early 2000s, I think. But anyways, Chris, thank you so much for coming on, man. This has been really, really just eye-opening for me and a great learning experience because is a little different from anyone that we've had on the show. I don't think we've had anybody in networking come on besides Gabe's background, but I know he enjoyed kind of going further into it, but thank you so much for coming on to the show and for giving us your time and just really valuable, man. Thank you.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thanks a lot. This was fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Absolutely. Sure. Hey, before we go, where can the folks find you? You're out there on the Twitterverse, LinkedIn. We'll put them in the show notes as well. Where are we looking you up?
Awesome. Yeah, on Twitter at Chris Grundemann. I've also got a website up that's kind of the hub for anything else you want to get to, which is chrisgrundemann.com. So from one of those two things, you can definitely find me and love to chat about any of these topics more.
Sounds good. And what about the folks at Myriad 360?
Yeah, it's just like it sounds, Myriad, M-Y-R-I-A-D 360.com. And that'll be a jumping off point for everything they've got as well.
Righteous. Well, thanks for coming on the show, man. We got to chat offline. It's weird. I can't recall ever running into you considering your background, where you lived and what you're into. So let's
kind of better have some overlapping circles somewhere. Let's talk about it.
Sure of it. Right on.
Awesome. Thanks, Chris. We'll see you next time.
Cheers. Cheers.
I just wanted to thank all of you out there for tuning in each and every week and to all of our amazing guests for coming on. I know that there are millions of other shows and it means the world to have you with us on this journey. We are so grateful that you choose to listen to us each and every week. If you like the show, tell a friend, have them tell their friends, and then maybe make some new friends along the way so we can continue to spread the word and keep learning together. Let's protect what matters most. And by the way, DJ, can you go ahead and drop that outro beat and keep it classy? We'll see y'all next week.